G'day and welcome to the Head Shepherd Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Ferguson, CEO here at NextGen Agri. I've worked in livestock research, farming and breeding for over 25 years. I've been very fortunate to see a lot of amazing places and meet a lot of wonderful people throughout that career. I'm reminded every day of just how awesome the livestock industry really is. It really is a great pleasure to bring you the stories and wisdom of the people in the industry via the Head Shepherd Podcast. This podcast is supported by our good friends at Allflex and MSD Animal Health, who are guided by the one mission of the science of healthy and productive animals. With these two companies now combined, they have one of the widest product portfolios in Australasia with a comprehensive lineup from the Cooper's range of animal health products through to the ID and monitoring solutions that Allflex are famous for. Their products are all backed up by their exceptional service, and we're thrilled to continue to have their support in bringing you this podcast each week. If I could ask a couple of small favours before we get underway this week, if you could rate this podcast in the app that you're listening to it in, that would be fantastic. Also, if you know someone that you think would enjoy what we do here, please share the show links with them. Finally, if you are listening to this podcast, you're probably a big fan of livestock farming. We're setting up the NextGen Agri Hub to be the home of livestock farming conversations. Check it out at thehub.nextgenagri.com. Okay, it's time for this week's guest. Welcome back to Head Shepherd. We're excited this week to be sharing the microphone with Prue Bonfield. Welcome, Prue.
How are you, Mark? I'm pleased to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, well, thank you. Enjoying the first half decent day of Kiwi summer over here. thanks for your time today. It's good to have a chat. I guess we might start off with a bit of your background. I guess some people will know a lot about you, and some people won't know much at all. We have listeners across all over the place, so obviously not a traditional pathway into agriculture.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess, you know, in terms of the beef industry or cattle, my association there started when I got married to my husband, who owned a Charolais stud just in southeast Queensland. My path to there was a little bit unusual, I suppose. I was a lawyer in Brisbane in Queensland, and happened on my husband at a BNS, which for New Zealand listeners is a bachelor and spinster's ball. I'm sure they wouldn't be allowed to call it that now. And you know, it was kind of city meets country in the very best way. Background is that, you know, David was on his parents' property at that stage and working for his parents, and we married and decided to make some changes. So that's kind of my background. We ran the Palgrove seed stock herd for 35 years, and I guess in summary, exited that business earlier this year, which we'd been partnering with New Zealand Superannuation Fund from New Zealand, of course, and now they fully own that operation. So that's kind of a short summary of, you know, what my background is.
Excellent. And obviously now sit on a range of boards and governance structures, and we won't maybe go through, we'll get to them at the end maybe, but we'll, obviously lots of involvement still in the industry, and I guess in maybe a more fun way and less of 24/7 way now that you're not having to run the business full time.
Yeah, and it's a really good way to describe that change, I think, is, you know, you're 24/7 fully responsible for absolutely everything that happens on farm and off farm. You know, you're marketing, you're kind of communicating, you're doing the finances, and it is a really holistic and full-on operation that we had. Now, to using some of that expertise that I'd gained over that period of time in a probably a high level in industry, I think I'm able to hopefully assist parts of industry to, you know, share that knowledge and understanding of what those big ticket items are, I think, for industry, and that comes with that, you know, lifelong knowledge, I think, and also an absolute interest in where the cattle industry is heading.
Yeah, definitely a lot of heaps of things, which is what we're talking about today, so that other people can learn from some of the things that you've learned along the way. And I guess it's not very common to have in a seed stock business to have a joint venture and get that capital in so that you can grow. And then, we'll be keen to explore that growth mindset and where that came about. I guess before we get into that, you've now built and exited a successful business. you and your husband David, and you obviously learned a lot of things on the hard way in doing that, no doubt we all have. With the power of hindsight, is there anything you would have done differently to get to where you are now?
I think everything we did had a purpose at the time, and it's really hard to sort of say that was wrong or a mistake. I guess what you do is you learn by trying, and we very much would, try and if it hadn't been invented, we'd try and develop it or pioneer something. And we found that over our life a lot, that we had to kind of develop different sort of, ways of breeding cattle, and we had to also, develop a different breed standard for us. And they're not sort of things you do differently, but they're certainly they make character because that those sorts of things are not easy. It's really easy to swim. It's really easy to swim in the tide when the tide's taking you, in a certain way and go with the flow. We tended not to do that, and I think at times, I've got quite a soft skin, a soft hide. So that was, there was some emotion always attached to that, being criticised for doing things, or people, sort of saying, what on earth are they doing that for? That I took that very personally. And I think you get over that when you sort of have some reasonable success and success in that things worked out the way we wanted them to. So I guess you got over that, fairly early on in my time as a farmer. And now I think when you look back on that sort of thing and think, well, actually that's what built those good foundations for where the business got to. If we wouldn't have made mistakes or tried things differently, we wouldn't have got here. I guess the one thing I do regret a little bit is that 7 day a week, full on business. That was something that I think now looking back, I wish we would have had more time doing family things on weekends. And every parent says that, I'm sure.
No, definitely. But I think there wouldn't be many farmers out there who aren't nodding away right now saying, yeah, we probably could have had more time. But I guess at the time, there is no time, and there's often in building a business, there's not a lot of money either. So you can't obviously buy people to do those jobs. So
yeah, absolutely.
Probably following on, but obviously emotion and economics are pretty closely linked in ag, and we're often in a business with our families, sort of perceived expectations from previous and future generations about what we should be doing. Our self-worth tends to be intimately tied to the business, which is very different to other, I guess, your previous career and other careers where you're sort of at, I guess you don't get away from it at 5:30 p.m, but you can definitely, you're much more removed than you are in agriculture. How have you navigated that over the years, and particularly with a sale of Palgrave, there would have been a bit of emotion involved there?
Absolutely. I mean, if you turn the clock right back, I remember when I first, came to Palgrave, my father-in-law, who was a great horseman, the worth of a man was how good a horseman they were. So I failed terribly at that from the start. And that, that was my first understanding of, it's not about what you know or, what's in your head or how smart you are or whatever. It's actually how you demonstrate that. And I think that was a really good lesson for me that, I know you'd hear farmers talk about their neighbours and whether they were a nice guy or not, at a party on a Saturday night, that didn't matter. It was how they ran their place and what was in their front paddock. And I think there is a lot of there is a lot of self-worth goes into that. So I think that really guided us a lot in our early development of the stud. We took over the stud from my father-in-law, or bought 50 cows from him, and that became, our business then. And from that time that we had control over it, it was all then about, what do we want to see here? What does this look like, and how do we want to feel about our business? And if you sort of do things half good or half right, you never really feel great about it. So all of the droughts and the financial sort of hardship of interest rates and everything, that doesn't feel great. It feels better if you're doing things really, really well to the best you can do it, and producing quality, at the other end, or a quality product at the other end, because we all go through those same circumstances. But if at that other end you can produce something that's so much better, that makes you feel great. So I guess, that emotion was naturally attached to that, and that's quite tough, because you feel every Every time you lose a calf, or every time your embryo transplant, they don't take, or what, it is very emotional, and it's frustrating, and it's all of those things, because you want to plow forward into that growth. You've got to sort of step back and say, well, actually, it's nothing we could control, and so we just have to let that go. And I think we then learnt a little bit of how to separate business from what else we do. And as soon as we did that, I think the business started to run a bit better, and we were able to think more logically rather than emotionally. And in seed stock, you have to do that. You know, we had, Sydney Show interbred champion cows that didn't get in calf the next year. So, we had to dispose of them because they didn't fit what we said we would, what we said we are. So you couldn't deviate from that. As sad as that was, they're going up that ramp to be loaded into a truck, you had to learn that the business meant that had to happen, because that's where you'd put your guideposts. And when you do that, it kind of makes it a bit easier, because you say, well, that's the criteria you have set yourself for your business. And every business who performs well will have that internally. There are no exemptions from that. There's no she was a lovely cow and we love her very much, but I'm sorry, she doesn't belong here anymore. So yeah, once we started to do that, life just became a little bit easier.
Yeah, it's a really fantastic example of it. And I think I always in presentations I give talk about how if you make that decision when emotion isn't involved, so you set those guide rails when you're not looking at that cow because she hasn't been born yet, you've set this an objective that if they don't get in calf, they're going up the ramp, and you've set that as a hard and fast rule. So it kind of makes that still a tough decision, but you know what that decision is before it needs to be made, which I think often in things like droughts and floods and all the things that farmers have to deal with, if you've got a bit of a plan prior to being in that emotive situation, it's easier to put that plan into place than it is to come up with it on the run and then try and sort of build it as you go, and then it's just straight emotion connected.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's having that plan, and part of that plan is broken down into, what do you want your product to represent? And if it doesn't represent that, it's not your product that you should be selling.
Yeah, exactly. Bouncing around a bit, but I'll go back to in that building phase. Obviously, Palgrave went from 50 cows to I'm not sure how big it ended up, but you'll tell me now how big it ended up when you exited. But I guess after answering that part of the question, what were the key factors in building that business? And we've already covered a few, obviously.
Yeah, look, back, we're talking sort of very late 80s, early 1990s. That's how old I am, Mark. But it was a matter of, we had very high interest rates back then in Australia. We had sort of, 20% interest rates. So it's very difficult. Even though land was relatively cheap, it was very hard to go to a bank and, ask for a lot of money to buy a lot of land. So what we did was we did the, adjustment and leased, and which is quite common in New Zealand, but not as common in Australia, and we, we increased our numbers and had a factory operating before we sort of bought the factory floor, if you know what I mean, and so that worked really well for us. So we had, productive animals ready to move on to any new land that we bought, and we bought in bits and pieces. That was our growth. We didn't know where it was going to end up, and we didn't intend to be massive and big. We wanted good and quality. And, once embryo transplants, started to become part of the norm in our business, in both, twice a year in autumn and spring, that really sort of, jumped our numbers up. And so then you'd have that, that problem of, well, what do we do with them now? We'll actually have to buy another property. And there was this sort of never-ending game of chase behind the production. And then that gets to a certain point where you become a big supplier. So once you become a big supplier, and they're to the big pastoral companies, bulls being sold in 200 lots, or we had, I think our biggest order was a 350 lot. And that's a lot of bulls leaving one place, and a lot of bulls that have to be all good, So that was a challenge. And so then we sort of became the corporate supplier, and that corporate supplier, you have to have bulls available whenever, you know, whenever that company needs them, and how many they need at that time. And you know, we did try very hard to do contract breeding, and that worked for a while, but companies come and go, and a lot of, you know, board decisions are made for companies, and you know, it doesn't always sit where, you know, where we wanted it to sit. So that was kind of difficult. So we knew we had to have those large numbers. So we then started to not be able to supply because those large numbers were coming more and more. And that's when we decided to do that that expansion that would get us there, and that looked like something that was too frightening for debt finance. So then we started to sort of think to ourselves, well, how do we raise some capital to find a partner who will be very much part of this growth story? And definitely part of that growth story was always to actually utilise bulls into our own commercial operation as well, and take it down the supply chain just one more step. Never to a branded product. We were always advised not to go there. It wasn't what we knew how to do and wasn't our expertise. So, you know, stick with what you know was sort of our mantra. I think it and a lot of businesses sort of come unstuck when they, you know, it's okay to do that in a small way. It's when you're doing it in a big supply environment, it's absolutely too difficult, because each part of that supply chain has to be working in sync, and that's not always possible with droughts and whatever. So we decided to sort of stick to what we know, and that's when we started to look for a partner who, I guess, had to have our values. And we did look all over the world. We were sort of they call it the dance. You do the dance, I think, when you're looking for capital, and you dance with different partners or potential partners, and finally you find that one that really fits. And most certainly with New Zealand Superannuation Fund, who had a long-term objective of what their investment looked like, matched our long-term objective of keeping that seed stock herd together and building it into a larger commercial operation as well. Long-winded story there, sorry, Mark.
No, it's great, and it's like very unique. It's probably not the only time it's happened, but it's certainly one of the only times I know of where, yeah, so it's like production business has gone to get outside capital, which is which is a route that is normal in Silicon Valley and other parts of the entrepreneurial world, where that's exactly how you would go about a growth strategy, and lots of businesses doing other stuff and consumer goods would have done in exactly that. And yet in ag, we probably get locked into that mindset that, yeah, if the bank won't give us the money, then we can't do it, or if we can't get it from, or if mum or dad won't agree to signing that loan, then we can't do it. But there's always several ways to skin a cat, and that's probably how you went about that. The most of that growth phase in, or the growth of Palgrove, is the if someone says no, you find someone that will say yes, or find a way to say yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it did take, you know, it sort of sounds like it was a quick operation. It wasn't, because the business had to be, the business definitely had to be ready for outside capital too. So we really worked hard to make sure that, you know, all the governance was in place, that, you know, the safety was in place, the environmental sort of structures were right. So, you know, in order to do that, you actually have to be operating as a corporate entity in a family business. And that's exactly what we, we really gave a lot of time into getting that right prior to looking for the capital.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. And I think that you often hear of sort of 10-year overnight successes, that everything seems like it happened in a week, but there's so much work that goes into it. And I guess that's sort of leads us on to governance. Obviously, good governance is the lifeblood of big corporations. Can also be very powerful in small business and small farming business, to allow that separation from emotion through to good decision making. You've obviously utilized governance structures throughout your career. Did that, was it only once you went to capital raising that you had governance in place, or did you already have a board set up?
No, look, we didn't have a board per se, but we did have a really, I guess, quite a unique decision making process. The first thing we did do is, you know, many years ago, I suppose about 15 years ago, we did seek out a business advisor, who was separate to our accountant. We always thought our accountant's exceptional for tax, and that's great, and keep that sort of, you know, nutted out, because that was where they'd protect us against paying too much tax and make sure, you know, we were all within the dotted lines. And then we sought out a business advisor and did a business plan 15 years ago at least, and that gave us a really different perspective, because he then became part of our decision-making process. We didn't get an advisory board as such, but what we did do is we'd always call in that that business advisor, and then we would seek his sort of view of the world in terms of finance and future look, and then we'd talk to our operations manager. Became very much part of, you know, we always call it the three-legged stool, because each of us had this really unique ability to look at decision-making differently. I used to do the facilitating, which was always quite fun with a couple of farmers. But by then they'd been quite, you know, they were quite used to whiteboards and lots of butcher's paper. And that's how we decision made. You know, any big decision, it started, and I always had the funnel, you know, the funnel process. You start big. And, you know, you have these lovely visions and let's draw a picture of what that looks like and where do we need to get to, and then just funnel it down as to, you know, what is our first step in getting there. And anything we've done has really been on that principle, and it just works so easily and works so well. And if you try and go the other way, or if, you know, one of the three or one of the four would start to head into the, you know, the smaller decision making down here, you just have to, everyone would bring them back and say, no, we start big and then we work out the plan on how to get there. And my goodness, it's just a really simple way to work out, particularly in farming and agriculture. And I think now for the sustainability, you know, everyone, you know, wanting sustainability as part of their operations, it's a really good way to do that too. You know, well, what does it look like? What do you want to get? And don't just start with carbon. Don't just start with soil and, you know, well, what are we going to do with it? It's kind of, you've just got to say, well, what's the picture? Who do we want to be in our business, and where does sustainability fit into that? And actually then how do we get there? So that one business advisor really changed our life. I did do the executive development program, the Rabobank program, that I know New Zealanders and Australians have been fortunate enough to be part of over the years, and that was a game changer as well. And I think that was back in 1999, I think, and just came back with all these ideas about how other businesses did their decision making, and that really, really helped, because there were, you know, Australian Stock Exchange listed businesses there. There were sort of, you know, mixed family businesses, and just looking to see what other people do, it gives you, you know, those great ideas. And it's really good just to get, you know, away from your comfort zone too.
Yeah, definitely. You only know what your friendship circle know pretty much. And so it's getting out into those different rooms. I just recorded my sort of New Year's message this morning, which will have probably played by the time this one's playing. But yeah, and sort of, yeah, talked a bit about that. If you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room, and the need to get into different people that can challenge your way of thinking and make you understand the alternative view, and rather than close our minds to what those alternative views are.
Absolutely.
You now sit on, so now sort of, I guess, still on Palgrave board maybe, but also on a range of other boards and connections right throughout the industry. What are your thoughts on the health of the industry at the moment, and what innovations do you think are required for the industry to take the next step? And I guess if we call the industry the Australian beef industry, we'll put that sort of boundary around it. But
yeah, it's interesting. I have been with a few New Zealanders lately, and it's pretty interesting to see where we're all at in terms of the cattle industry. And obviously, you know, prices are just mad over here, and you know, land is horrendously dear, and you know, it's just been a fabulous 2 years since the end of the 2 year drought. And I tell you what, everyone needs a couple of good years under their belt after a drought like that. It was horrendous. But I think that, you know, and I do sit on some boards, and they're one of them is an agri tech company called Black Box Co. And it's fantastic, because it gives me a really good insight into, you know, what farmers are asking for in terms of really practical, good technology. And I think there's probably too many of the ag tech sort of guys out of Sydney and Melbourne particularly who sort of say, look, I've just, you know, invented this wonderful widget for you, you must need it, and then get terribly upset, you know, 12 months later when no one's bought it. And, you know, the industry is really good at finding its own solutions. It just needs someone to come along with it and be innovative with it and invent what we don't know how to do. And most of that is the sort of the build of data, you know, data software or whatever it is. And if we could just all work together a bit more, it just seems ridiculous for ag tech in, you know, inventors or innovators not to be working with real-time farmers and saying, well, you know, what is it that you need that solution for? And it's frustrating from our end too, knowing that there's a whole internet of things out there, but what's suitable for me and what can I do with that data and how will it actually benefit the whole industry? And I think there is that sense now that I haven't seen before of a working together and working as one industry. And I think that comes when you when your back's up against the wall a little bit and you're being defensive, that is never going to work. I think now farmers are starting, particularly in cattle industry grazing, that they can actually be part of the solution, and how wonderful someone's asking us to be part of that solution, whether it's capturing, you know, carbon or whatever, or reducing emissions or whatever, but talk to us about how we can do it and stop, you know, just throwing rotten eggs at us. And I think that it's almost like that bell curve, that curve has, it's really just starting to change. And I think it's really only been in the last 6 months even that I've seen a real change in that. It's let's actually talk to the farmers and let's bring them in on the conversation. In Australia, that's really, I think, changed with, you know, our National Farmers Federation is working really hard at bringing all industries together under this sustainability framework. And that's a key part of our future. I think it's a key part of working together for that future, and whether you're in grain or cotton or cattle or sheep or whatever it is, we all sort of have these, we all do have these common problems or ways to deal with, you know, problems. Let's all work together and actually, and I think it's the first time that I've seen Australian commodities working, you know, as one. And that to me is really exciting. And I guess I sort of see that in the cattle industry. We've just had, I don't know if you know, we've had a big change in the structure of who runs the grass-fed, you know, cattle organisation in Australia. And it's a new board, a new organisation called Cattle Australia. And I think it'll be a new way to look at things, perhaps as business people rather than as emotive farmers, which we talked about before. And I think when you take the emotion out of it, you know, when people say, oh, leave us alone, we'll get it done and we'll do it. Well, I've got to be able to trust you in order for you to be able to say that to me. And I think that's where that new organisation will build that trust, both from an environmental and animal welfare and government point of view, but also from a farmer point of view that, you know, we need an organisation we can trust that they're doing things in our best interests as well. And I think, you know, it might be a little bit sort of, you know, Peter Pan of me to say this, but I just think solutions are so much better when you get two parties together negotiating compromise and how do we work this through, rather than, I've never been a conflict-minded person. I just, and maybe it's the lawyer in me, I think mediation's always better than, you know, going to court or, you know, fighting. I headed up the Australian Beef Industry Sustainability Framework Committee, the inaugural one, and that was an interesting time to be doing that because it was about 6 or 7 years ago, and you know, the WWF, it seemed like, you know, they were versus, you know, the Australian cattlemen, and it was just a really tough time to talk sensibly from both sides, I think. So I sort of, you know, had to navigate that, which was fairly interesting because the trust was in me to be able to almost bring two sides together, and I didn't see it that way. I just thought, well, what can I learn? And I went and talked to everyone from, you know, our animal welfare, not so much activists, but our RSPCA and our you know, the WWF, and I actually found out a whole lot from them that was, you know, being reported wrongly in the media, and they found out from us, you know, that they had things wrong too. So that path is always better. You'd get a better solution out of that. And I think we're on our way to starting to talk that way here in Australia. It's a little different, I think, Mark, in New Zealand, and, you know, I certainly wouldn't go into to that that sort of battle, but it is different. And I always think that regulation and statutory sort of, you know, imposts will always come on you if you're not progressing fast enough. And I didn't think, you know, in Australia, I didn't think we were progressing fast enough 7 years ago. I think we are really on target now. So I think that's the future for grazing and cattle and our whole industry in Australia is let's talk. And I think you could probably put that same hat on the supply chain. You know, we're talking more and more. We've got more and more data going right through to the processor and back again. And that's got to be a magic thing for, you know, for a whole industry to work together in that way as well.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, it's a really insightful answer to that question and, yeah, really interesting to think about. And it's awesome to hear that you think that way, that we are getting more aligned. Cause, yeah, I agree. I've certainly probably haven't shied away from conflict enough in my career, but trying to do more of that and more, and definitely looking for collaborations and connections because, yeah, just, yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. Sometimes you're dealing with antagonistic bodies and trying to find common ground is good, but even competing bodies on doing the same thing, when you agree on the same thing, there's still room for that collaboration and often a better outcome. Mm. One last question, I think, which I don't think was on the list, but one thing that's always, I think, something that needs to be called out quite often in ag is imposter syndrome. You coming in as a law-trained person into the agriculture industry and now having lots of different positions across the industry, I think we definitely all suffer from imposter syndrome. How did you get around imposter syndrome and sort of feeling that you weren't worthy of having those positions or someone else should be better placed to have that opinion or whatever, which is obviously not true, but we often convince ourselves that is true.
Mark, I sort of think it's not a bad thing to have, you know, a little bit of that because you've got a humility in you if you've got that, and I think it's a worry when you don't have a little bit of it. I mean, you know, I was on committees early only because I just used to stay awake at night and think, oh gosh, that could be better done, or I could do a better job on that. And if you don't jump in and do that, you know, well, you're the imposter then because you feel you've got and know maybe you do have something to offer. And if you don't jump in and do something, you know, that's when you've let everyone down or let yourself down. So I there were many times, you know, right back, I can remember, you know, being on breed society committees and things like that where I think I was the token woman or, you know, the only woman and that was really tough because you feel like you feel a little bit sort of out of the conversation in the breaks, you know, that always be sort of the shoulder. You'd be shouldered out of the boys' talk on golf or whatever, and that's all fine. That you deal with that. But I sort of found, you know, sometimes that worked to your advantage because you could just ask, you know, and it's such a nice way, a question that, you know, most people would expect that men would know or whatever it was. So I did a lot of asking of questions. And when you're not a farmer, you're not a farmer's daughter or whatever, no one expects you to know anything. So that's a really good, it's a great thing to have because you can surprise people with what you've learned. And I just can't stop learning. I don't know how many sort of, you know, postgraduate things I've done over my latest one is I did a circular economy and sustainability course about 6 weeks ago out of Cambridge Judge Business School, and I just loved every minute of it. And so I think that's it. I think you can stay relevant and have something to say if, A, you've got that, and I hate to say the word passion, but it is an absolute passion for what you believe in, and that is, you know, that beef is great and, you know, agriculture is great and all of those things, but you got to really believe that. And I suppose, you know, I learn that way, that I'm a formal learner. I like to have information and then sort of, you know, toss it around a bit and see how it can be used in my industry. And that is, you know, that course gave me that really good insights into, you know, what to next. And that's, you know, particularly in our own, we have our own farm still, and we didn't sell that into the partnership. So we're reinventing our own enterprise at home as a family, sustainable family enterprise now. And it's really exciting because we get to start from scratch again and do things differently to what we would have done 30 years ago. So that's been a bit of fun. And I think, you know, the industry over here is actually full of young people that are really inspiring and exciting as well. And I don't know about New Zealand, but there is a race to get in that door at the moment, from, you know, university trained to really practical, skillful sort of young agricultural people. And I think the technology has really brought them along, because, you know, you've got kids who are brilliant at finance and maths and, you know, data, and they're bringing along the rest of us into a whole new world as well. And if we don't jump on that train, we'll sort of wake up and miss it. So I find that really exciting and really interesting. But that the imposter thing, you know, I don't know the first thing about data builds or, you know, IT engineering or anything like that. And I'm quite happy at my age to just say, look, I don't know what you're talking about, but I do know that we can, you know, do a, you know, bring in capital this way. So there are, everyone's got some expertise in something. It's just how you transfer that across different parts of the industry. And, you know, I sit on a Live Corp board, a Live Export board, and, you know, I've learnt an awful lot in the last sort of 2 years or so, but I find that industry just incredibly proud of what they do and really just working hard to make sure that they're meeting expectations of all of the stakeholders. Amazing, you know, and the group of young people in that industry are just, they collaborate, they work together, they're, you know, and you don't see that from the outside, but I've been lucky enough to see that from inside that industry. And I think you'll find that across all agricultural industries now. There's a real turning point, and it's quite recent.
Mm. Yeah, and I think what we see here in New Zealand is, and I obviously, yeah, get to spend a lot of time in both places, but yeah, there's definitely a continued pride in agriculture here, but yeah, definitely a growing interest, and yeah, there's plenty more jobs than there are people to fill them, and like there's competition to be in the right jobs, and yeah, I agree with you, we're in a great time in agriculture. There's a lot of passionate young people that are really keen to come into it. I know in our AI, artificial intelligence sort of offshoot business, we've got four people who have no idea about agriculture really, but spend all day working in agriculture from artificial intelligence end, which is, yeah, and that's the kind of things that we're going to see more and more in ag as technologies come to the sector, and because we are, end of the day, I think people love doing something real, and agriculture, you can't get much more real than agriculture, and they feel like they're contributing to something that's significant, and that's a great place to be. Mm. We might wrap it up there, Prue. It's been fantastic to hear your insights. I know you're an inspiration to many, and I really appreciate your time today to come on and share that part of your story and part of your journey, and all the best for the next chapter, which is getting back to the family farm by the sound of it.
Yeah, a little bit of that. It's kind of, well, you know, my husband's, he's been doing a bit of consulting since, you know, since we both, you know, jumped off the board in April this year as well, and that sort of part of, you know, the partnership has all finished with New Zealand Super. But, yes, I said to him he's going to sort of have to stay at home a little bit more. He's kind of, been doing a fair bit of consulting work, and, you know, it certainly wasn't meant to be retirement, but I said it was, you know, it was meant to be a different, commitment. So we'll have that discussion again over Christmas, I think. I guess that's so much part of what's so good now is that, you know, you get to share what you've learnt, and, you know, me with my boards and whatever, but him with his consulting, and it comes easily because, there's not much you haven't seen after a while. After a few years, Mark, you'll get there one day. But when you get to a certain age,
I'm growing rapidly.
All good. Thanks for your time. That's been great to chat.
Thanks, Prue. Thanks very much. Thanks for listening to the Ed Shepherd Podcast. If you enjoy listening in each week, please take a moment to subscribe or even give us a review. That'd be fantastic. And if you do get a moment to share it with your networks, we'd also love that so that we can share these great stories with more people. Thanks again to our friends at Allflex for sponsoring this episode. Allflex are wonderful supporters of the Australian and New Zealand livestock industries. Combined now with MSD Animal Health, they offer one of New Zealand and Australia's largest livestock product portfolios focused on animal health and management, all backed up by that exceptional service. We really do enjoy our long-term association with Allflex and thank them very much for again supporting us with bringing this podcast to you.